treaty holders, the Mississaugas of New Credit First Nation. We acknowledge that this land was occupied and valued and cared for and depended on by these nations long before European settlers arrived. This territory where the Great Lakes drain is subject to the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt, an inter-Indigenous covenant between Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee nations, to not take more than you need, to leave something in the dish for others, and to keep the dish and the territory clean. We acknowledge that when European settlers first came to this land, they also entered into a sacred treaty with the Indigenous people here, the Two Row Wampum, an agreement to peaceably share and care for the Great Lakes region. We acknowledge that this treaty and many others have been and continue to be violated by European and Canadian colonial practices that exploit and spoil the land, the water, the air, and all beings that live here. We acknowledge that we are all treaty people, and that whatever we do to the land and to others, we do to ourselves. We seek new ways of being in relationship with Indigenous peoples who are our hosts, and with this land bring to our guests. I offer this somewhat longer and expanded acknowledgement today because questions of land, colonialism, and fractured relationships between white settlers and Indigenous peoples and the land on which we live and work today, these issues are taken up in some depth in this edited volume. In the introduction, for example, by Mark and Leah, and the chapters by Adrian, Mandita, and Leah. Our colonial past and present cannot be separated from questions of work, political economy, social inequality, and progressive social change. So we look forward to this discussion. And I want to first, before we get into more of the book, introduce to you Tom Lovell, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Graduate Studies, to offer some points of order. Oh, and I will mention, I have here an attendance sheet, or just a sign-up sheet. This is for our records at the Global Labor Research Center, and I'll circulate this while we get started. Thank you. Tom.
So, I just want to welcome you to this event, the launch of Change and Continuity, Canadian Political Economy in the New Millennium, about which we will hear much more from others much better qualified than I to speak to. But by way of introductory comment, however, I want to draw attention to and then applaud collaboration and generosity, which depends on the characters of these editors of the volume, as well as that of the Global Labor Research Center, based in the Faculty of Liberal Arts and Professional Studies. Organized research units can intensify the already wonderful work of graduate programs by allowing for cross-disciplinary intellectual and professional collaboration. However, they can also provide intellectual and professional opportunities for professors, postdoctoral researchers, and graduate students that know, or I'll use safer language, that few programs are able to offer or to provide on their own. So kudos to the faculty also for its support of the ORU, and also kudos to current and past directors and coordinators of the center, because you play a big role in creating this kind of collaboration and nurturing the generosity across people in different stages. Because this is collaboration in this volume, especially, that reaches across different career stages and disciplines, and it's demonstrated everywhere in this book. In terms of the editors of this volume, we've got a doctoral candidate, an assistant at the time, assistant professor, associate, and a full professor, with many, many other kudos to all of their names. We have sociology, politics, and social science all coming together just with the editors. And as Professor Bosco noted to me, a key goal of the project was to engage the research work of scholars from different stages and generations. Three contributors were former doctoral students in poli-sci. Rebecca Hall is now Assistant Professor of Development Studies at Queen's University. Simon Black is now Assistant Professor of Labor Studies at Brock University. Tobin LeBlanc-Haley is now Assistant Professor of Community Studies at the University of Cape Breton. And Olena Dubchenko, currently a doctoral candidate in poli-sci, is a contributor and editor of the volume, which is highly impressive. So who is Olena? Hello, Olena. Noted.
Thank you.
So please join me in congratulating the editors, the contributors to this volume, and to the Global Labor Research Center. Thanks.
Thanks to all of you for coming out to this event, to the launch of this volume. We had a launch earlier in the summer at Congress, but it was at a time when the book wasn't quite out in hard copy yet, and so this feels even more big now that the book does exist and we can hold it in our hands. I'm going to say a few words to, I guess, introduce this event and to introduce the volume and where it came from, and then we're going to, a number of the contributors, not all, but a number are here, and so we're going to take some time to hear from people about their various chapters. To get things started, though, I should also thank the Global Labor Research Center itself. The book, this particular volume, began in a workshop at the Global Labor Research Center back in December of 2015, so it feels like a while ago now. And that was a great start to what turned into be a really interesting and what I hope is an important collection and a great experience of working with a number of really inspired scholars. We should also thank, of course, McGill Queen's University Press and Philip Ciccone and the work they did to bring the book together. And me personally, I would like to thank, in particular, along with all of the contributors, the co-editors, and the four of us worked closely over a number of years in bringing this together, and it was really great to work with Leah and Carlo and Elena to pull this book into what it became. One last acknowledgement, and that is to someone who's not here in the room with us today, and that is Wally Clement, who has the lead chapter in the volume. And Wally, the book is dedicated to Wally, and in recognition of the contributions he's made over to Canadian political economy scholarship. And the four of us and many contributors have been influenced and inspired by his work in many ways. And so we felt it important to dedicate the book to him. This it was for myself it was a real honor to contribute to this book and to this series. The book is the fourth in a series of books on Canadian political economy coming out of McGill Queen's University Press. The first one goes back to 1989, so this is 30 years now since that series started, and so it was nice to have a book come out on the 30th anniversary of the inception of that series. And for me, it was that was the first year I started as an undergraduate student in sociology and political science at Carleton University. After briefly failing out as an engineer, I found a better path here now. And that book, the first one, edited by Wally Clement and Glenn Williams, and including a number of contributors from Carleton and York, of course, was really influential in helping shape my understanding of what political economy was and what political science and sociology could be as critical social science disciplines. And so I took a lot of inspiration from that. And then over the years, two others came out, one in the late 1990s, edited by Wally, and then another in the early 2000s, edited by Leah Wally. And again, these books really, I found inspiring in many ways in terms of offering examples of critical social science research that was academically rigorous and also oriented towards the dynamics of social change, a scholarship that's really trying to connect to and inform progressive social change and movements for social justice taking up a wide array of topics. And as we put together this volume, we really wanted to build on that tradition that those earlier books had established. And we, of course, wanted to push in some new directions. And so as we invited contributors and began conceptualizing chapters and thinking about what this book was about, we tried to find the core themes and frameworks within Canadian political economy as a field of study, and engage with them and build on them, and then also try to push forward and find some new directions. And so hopefully the volume captures both aspects of what we're trying to do. So as you can see up here, the way we've organized it, it ended up coming together into five different sections that we feel capture some of the core elements of what this book is, and perhaps some core themes within Canadian political economy more broadly. The book begins with a theoretical overview from Wally Clement, Leah Bosco, and Anita Sharma, and then focuses in four particular thematic clusters: regions and resources, the state, capital, and institutions, social services restructuring, and contestation. The authors in various ways draw, of course, upon Marxist scholarship to understand the class dynamics of contemporary capitalism in Canadian society, but also draw from a number of theoretical frameworks and paradigms to try to engage with a wide array of social relations around gender, around race, around disability, around citizenship status, to try to construct a holistic account of the dynamics of capitalism, the ways in which capitalism is changing in the Canadian context, and the ways in which, of course, the agency of movements and of people are contributing to the transformation. We don't take this to be a representative or complete accounting of political economy, Canadian political economy, but we've tried to capture a number of strands and pull them together under this theme of change and continuity. A number of the chapters engage with this, trying to think through, in terms of Canada's political economy, what are the changing dynamics that are at play, whether it's in urban centers or in remote resource-driven economies. And at the same time, what are the underlying social relations of capitalism that continue to persist and to shape this changing context? In terms of particular substantive topics, we have, again, a wide array of themes that the contributors take up, beginning with the study of precarious employment. We have chapters engaging with the legacy of Harold Innes and Staples theory. We have chapters studying urban political economy, social movements, the experiences of people with disabilities, the role of the state, of course, in the neoliberal era, institutions such as the healthcare institutions, a wide array, and we're going to hear about some of these from the contributors who are going to come up here and speak. So I'm going to conclude here, and what I'll do is offer just the final thoughts on what we had hoped to accomplish in this book was to as we connect with and build upon the tradition of Canadian political economy scholarship that we saw, in the series from McGill Queens, and of course also in the journal Studies of Political Economy, and in a wide array of forums that are out there. We tried to build on this scholarship and also hopefully chart some new directions for Canadian political economy scholarship as we move into the new millennium, because really I think all of us who were involved in this volume, certainly the co-editors and certainly the contributors, feel that there's much more to do within this field of study. So on that, I'm going to wrap up, and what we're going to do now is we're going to hear from a couple of our co-editors, first Leah Bosco and then Carlo Finelli, and then a number of the contributors. Not everyone was able to make it here, but a number are here. They've all promised me to offer short, concise synopsis of their contributions, and of course, you'll want to hear more, so the book is available to purchase at the back of the room. And then we're going to conclude. Olena Lubchenco is going to wrap up talking about expanding the boundaries of Canadian political economy. And in her chapter, she takes some of the framework and looks at a discussion of maternity capital benefit program in the Russian case. So, with that, thank you for coming, and we will now hear from Leah Boston.
Now, since Mark and I co-wrote the introduction, our editorial collective decided that I would use my time to talk about the theoretical contributions of the book. And so what I will say is that, as just to echo what Mark said, this volume, of course, arises from a lineage of scholarship on Canada's political economy established in a series of volumes. But the essays in this one offer theoretical innovation, we would suggest, by drawing from and bridging insights from contemporary feminist theory, critical race theory, and citizenship and migration studies to expand and challenge the lens of Canadian political economy, or CPE, and the ways in which this lens can both enrich and inform us. So through a materialist approach grounded in political economy, volume contributors engage with themes such as shifts in immigration policy, the persistence of settler colonialism, contemporary social movements, and resource development extraction, as well as issues including precarious employment, the experiences of people with disabilities, the renewal and revitalization of workers' movements, and Indigenous women's struggles to engage in production for subsistence. Whereas previous volumes focused on seeing and using political economy as transformation, both methodologically and substantively, in pursuing the theme of change and continuity, in this volume, contributors explore the legacy of Canadian political economy scholarship in terms of its continued relevance to understanding Canada's contemporary political economy, while identifying new theoretical directions that we hope will give the field, or contribute to giving the field, analytical resonance in the new millennium. So beyond this overarching emphasis, I would say that some themes define the volume. The volume's first theme, in my view, relates to tensions and contradictions as sources of challenge and change. And this theme is arguably a defining feature of the political economy tradition in Canada, one that has guided empirical studies of Canada's political economy, through which scholars have sought to locate processes of social change within tensions generated by unequal political economic conditions, including those stemming from processes of globalization and international influences like U.S. hegemony. The initial chapter of our volume takes up this theme boldly through a review of the CPE tradition. Wallace Clement's chapter, Locating the New Canadian Political Economy, highlights a series of contradictions that have driven the intellectual currents of CPE forward and contributed to its transformation. Tensions created through Canada's integration into the global economy are also notable in Nandita Sharma's chapter, The Political Economy of Belonging, the differences that Canadian citizenship and immigration policies make, which takes as its point of departure what appears as a central contradiction characterizing the contemporary Canadian labor market, that is, the simultaneous presence of anti-immigration discourses, which we see everywhere in Canada, alongside the increasing number of people entering Canada on temporary migrant work programs. So Sharma explores how this tension is productive for Canadian capitalism in the current period of neoliberal globalization, where citizenship and immigration policy becomes a way in which capitalist social relations at the global scale come to be operative within individual nation states, and whereby those without Canadian citizenship status, including migrant workers, are subject to interacting processes of oppression, including racism and labor exploitation. Now, Steve Tufts will speak for himself and for his chapter with Suzanne Mills shortly, Innocence Ghost, but they likewise highlight the tensions associated with the interconnected processes of globalization and financialization. They point to how Canada's resource sector has become increasingly globally integrated and financialized since the 80s, producing an increase in foreign ownership within Canada's resource industries, while making Canada a global leader in mining finance capital. Likewise, Peter Gray, who was unable to be here today, in his chapter on the political economy of Quebec capitalism, contends that the neoliberal project in Quebec under the Parti Québécois took a specific form of competitive nationalism as a way to link a commitment to the rules of global capitalism with a set of national progressive values. And this unique tension opens space, he argues, for a range of institutions, including community organizations, women's organizations, and student movements, to tie their demands to the reproduction of national legitimacy. Grace therefore calls for a political analysis that sees the nation state as torn between two contradictory directions, the adoption of global standards of economic competitiveness and the reproduction of national legitimacy. And he views this source of this contradiction as a source of challenge and change. The second insight and theoretical contribution, I think, of the chapters is the notion that context matters. This orientation, of course, reflects the broad thrust of historical materialism in the work of Marx and Engels, insofar as it pushes political economy scholars to pay close attention to the particularities of historical moments, as well as the legacies set in place through historical developments that may shape material conditions and social relations. And so at one level, several contributions show how context shapes change. And a brilliant example here is found, and I don't know if he's here, I think he maybe didn't make it today, is found in Adrian Smith's chapter towards a critique of political economy of sociolegality in settler capitalist Canada, which pursues a case study of agri-food, migrant worker housing disputes, in southwestern Ontario's Norfolk County in the early 2010s, and illustrates the weight of settler colonialism's legacy manifest in a global context at the present day. And I, too, in my own chapter on the regulation of employment standards, similarly try to show how parameters of who is exempt from certain social minima provided under the province's Employment Standards Act reflects an outmoded understanding of what are deemed to be normal workplaces or normal workplace contexts, not to mention which groups are deemed to be typical workers. So in this case, home care employees are my focus, and their numbers have grown, and they perform a great deal of personal support work, often for clients with disabilities and seniors. They're deemed exceptional on account of the historical devaluation of so-called women's work on the market, and these tensions intersect with processes of racialization. These employees' exceptionality under the Employment Standards Act means that they're only entitled to a minimum wage for a maximum of 12 hours per day, and they're exempt from employment standards provisions related to hours of work, daily rest periods, time off between shifts, bi-weekly rest periods. And so what I do is I try to show that with respect to the realization of minimum standards, the largely arbitrary context of the occupational group to which an employee belongs affects access to rights and protections, contributing to a more precarious experience for those many marginalized, racialized immigrant women in home care. A third prominent theme that runs across the collection is the theme of continuity through change. And this, we try to capture this in the ways in which the highly dynamic and fluid nature of capitalism notwithstanding, core social relations persist across time and space, and these contribute to shaping Canada's contemporary political economy. And a really great example here is Jim Stanford's chapter on staple development renewed and betrayed, and in Canada's 21st century boom and bust, where he suggests that this shift has had ideological roots, namely a return to classical political economics model of comparative advantage from the previous post-war era of national industrial development. And so Stanford demonstrates the continuity through change, and in doing so, it enables him to illustrate that Canada's renewed reliance on natural resources, especially petroleum extraction in his case, in the 2000s has contributed to deindustrialization. A fourth preoccupation of the many contributions in the volume is with understanding underexplored phenomena by centering the margins and destabilizing the center. So tracing a trajectory back to Marx's approach to political economy, this concern is akin to his determination to reveal the underlying social relations obscured by the surface appearance of things in capitalism, such as the so-called fair exchange between the worker and employer, of labor power for a wage, something that can only be revealed when one sought to enter the mode of production. So in the vein of contesting common sense and common sense understandings of social phenomena, contributors push the boundaries of this exercise by using the analytical tools of political economy to contest dominant social relations. And in doing so, marginalized social groups are brought to the center of the analysis. Such phenomena are captured quite well by Tobin LeBlanc Haley's examination in her chapter, Mad Reproduction, Defining Mental Illness in a Neoliberal Age in Ontario, of a new definition of mental illness in Ontario, wherein mad people are constructed as potentially productive citizens in housing and employment policy. And similarly, Rebecca Hall, who's unable to be here today as well, her exploration of the marginalization of Indigenous people through the development of the Canadian economy in her chapter, A Feminist Political Economy of Indigenous State Relations in Northern Canada, shines a light on a gap characterizing both the new Canadian political economy tradition and a feminist political economy perspective. And that is the failure to situate Northern Indigenous women's labor within a mixed economy, specifically to attend to their contribution to local subsistence. The fifth and final theme of the volume, a theoretical theme of the volume, relates to the reorganization and realignment of state structures. An enduring feature of Canadian political economy is that the institutions of the state still matter, especially as they interrupt the modes of accumulation. In an era of neoliberalism, state structures have, of course, been profoundly reorganized, realigned to enhance market processes with and multiple effects. So this theme runs through many of the chapters in the volume and serves as a direct challenge to the neoliberal free market discourse that, invoking a version of Adam Smith's notion of the invisible hand, so often proclaims the economic virtues of the non-intervention state. Indeed, Stephen McBride, who was to be here today but couldn't come in the end, his chapter on From Keynesianism to Neoliberalism, the State in the Global Context, shows neoliberal states remain highly active in the regulation of contemporary economies in a variety of ways. Moreover, interventionism has become much more overtly aligned with the interests of capital in the neoliberal era. So a number of chapters provide additional examples of this phenomenon. For instance, the chapter that Hugh Armstrong will talk about that he wrote with Pat Armstrong and Tamara Daly shows that neoliberal restructuring led provincial and territorial governments to turn to marketization and corporate ownership, and through funding cutbacks to pressure nursing homes to contract out services. So these are but five sub-themes that we identify in our volume, and I think now I'll turn it over to the rest of the contributors to talk about the contribution that I wouldn't have enough time to really.
So now we'll hear from Carlo Nelli, who's assistant professor in the Work and Labor Studies program here at York. Earlier at another event today, Carlo, I confess I introduced you as working at Carleton.
Okay. Okay, I do work here.
And I'm confirming that I realized that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So thank you to everyone. I want to talk a little bit about what's not in the book, because I think these backstories are often interesting. I know the guys, this was this person's supervisor and took a class with them and so forth. So I thought it would be worthwhile just to spend a few minutes to spend some time talking about that. I must admit the impetus for this book was a profound sense of desperation. And what I mean by that was it was actually initially spurred by kind of informal email to Wally Clement back in 2012-13, who at that time was on my dissertation committee, when I asked him why the Canadian Political Economy series hadn't been updated in some 13, 14 years. And I had asked him just informally at the time, you know, are you planning on updating this anytime? And he kind of wrote back to me, laughing out loud. So he wasn't planning on doing that, he mentioned. So it was about a year later in 2014 when I pressed Wally a little bit and I sent him an email asking again if he would be interested in revising or updating rather this collection. And this was at the time when it was just about wrapping up my dissertation. And, of course, I was still using the Opanage's 1977 edited book, The Canadian State, as well as the, you know, Wally Clement and Glenn Williams 1989 version of this, and then the 96 version and the 2003 version. And Wally responded this time a little more serious, saying, I'm actually close to retirement. I'm not planning on updating this, and CC'd Leah on it, and asked if, Leah, maybe you'd be interested in this time. And of course, Leah is not known for having a light research load, and unfortunately at the time she wasn't able to take it on. But both Leah and Wally suggested that if I was interested in kind of, seeing where it would go. And so I emailed Mark, who 6 years earlier, the both of us now, ourselves, about 15 years ago now, was my MA supervisor here at York, right? So it's funny how these things are connected. So I asked Mark if he'd be interested in maybe thinking about how we could take this on. And Mark, being Mark, of course, was very enthusiastic and supportive, and said, "Yeah, we should do it. Let's think about it." And so we initially put together a rough draft of articles, and we emailed both Wally and Leah again, letting them know, or rather asking them and letting them know that we were interested in taking this on. And fortunately, this time Leah was now able to come apart. I'm not sure if it's because Mark was now on it or not, but I'm kidding aside. I'm glad that she was able and willing to work with an unknown entity, and myself not really having, have known each other very informally and everything like that. So long story short, it was at that time where I managed to look in the archives of my email, and I found an email from Mark when we were initially, this is back in 2014, when we were thinking about how to go about this, and I'm going to quote Mark right here. He said, "I think it's important to develop a text that is as forward-looking as possible, one that presents the Canadian political economy tradition in a way that can be applied to understanding the world today. And I think as the volume progressed, we did, in fact, try to make it very political, connecting both the theoretical and the methodical, these very methodological approaches to concrete issues and how they affect everyone in their day-to-day lives." So since that time, moving forward to 2014 and 15, we contacted a number of people to be interested in the project. We held a symposium in the fall of 2015. It was about that time where Elena also came on board. We were very happy because we were all, as we mentioned earlier, we were all at very different stages of our careers. But I think it really was a form of mentorship, certainly bringing together not only these different approaches within the Canadian political economy tradition, but people at different stages of their lives. The book was submitted in early 2017, and after about a year or so of review and then some back and forth and some more review, it was finally published in June 2019. So this book is, in a sense, some 6 or 7 years in the making, and building on some 30 or 40 years of research before that. So that's kind of how the book came to fruition, and I wanted to just give an overview of that. I just want to spend 1 minute. Of course, I want to thank my co-editors and other contributors for that, but I also want to spend just a minute mentioning working with Greg. Greg Albo was my co-author with this piece, and our contribution to the urban political economy tradition. In many senses, Canada, perhaps uniquely, doesn't have an endogenous kind of Canadian urban political economy tradition. It was always kind of an afterthought to larger discussions and issues around left nationalist approaches, Quebec sovereignty, Canada's relationship to its dependent orbits of the United States, and so forth. Greg is encyclopedic, and Greg has always been very supportive of my work, and I certainly do appreciate that. And I think two of the central contributions of our article is twofold. One is to really try and think about the way Canada at the time of Confederation and subsequently our Constitution was really developed at a time when the urban realities of today were really an afterthought. So all the important urban social services, urban public services that municipalities provide were secondary or an afterthought. So I think our Constitution hasn't, as Greg will discuss, hasn't really reflected the way that urban life generally has changed so much. The second big contribution I think our chapter does is show how efforts to reduce both municipal workers' compensation stem not from over-generous pay or out-of-control public finances, but really reflect attempts to harmonize downwards the wages and working conditions of unionized and non-unionized workers while privatizing urban public services and assets. And we do this through a case study of looking at the crisis of affordability in Vancouver, the crisis of infrastructure in Montreal, and urban labor strife here in the city of Toronto. And of course, there's whole swaths of all the interesting theoretical and methodological approaches in that as well. I will leave it there. And again, I want to thank all of you for being here today, and looking forward to hearing from everyone else.
Okay, so we do have a list of contributors. As I mentioned, not all are here, but I believe next on our list is Steve Tufts from the Department of Geography here at York, who's going to give a brief discussion of Carol Dennis and the Staples theory. What we might think about him.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all the editors for putting this collection together. I think it's really useful. When I got my first copy, the hard copy, I started going through and reading some of the articles that were first presented in that workshop. And I told Mark, I don't think you realize what you have here. This is a really good collection. Please launch the fuck out of it. And I'm hoping that it does get read and taken up in a whole bunch of places beyond York. The chapter that Suzanne Mills and I wrote, she unfortunately can't be here today, it really reflects our similar training as geographers and as Canadianists in our backgrounds and being exposed not only to the collections that Mark first mentioned, but also to the earlier works of Harold Innes and what his legacy is on Canadian political economy. And we really wanted to see and explore and trace some of Innes's ideas, how they were taken up in earlier iterations, going back to first debates with McIntosh, up into the new political economy, and more recently. And we sort of came up with this metaphor that he is a ghost. His intellectual legacy is very present, even if his initial thought isn't alive in every respect. And that's the metaphor we sort of use. And the things that we want to bring through in this chapter is that Innes's thought, very important to geographers, because really we think he's relevant at the sub-national scale of analysis. He really tells us not just about national development and resource dependency, he really tells us about uneven development at the sub-national scale and regional underdevelopment and regional dependence on resources. Second thing, a criticism of Innes that we think is really still only going to be explored is there isn't a full explication of the role of coloniality in this work and the implications of colonialism in Canada as a white settler nation. That's something that he really didn't totally ignore in his work, but only glazed over, and even some of the folks who took him up later on didn't fully explicate. But when we get to the theme of the book, which is Canada's changing resource economy and the importance of extraction, we do see these tensions between what are these breaks and continuities within an Innesian tradition on Staples theory and Staples dependence. And some of the things we identify are, first of all, that Indigenous conflict is still, and Indigenous activism is still very much linked to land and resource extraction. And these are going back to the Staples tradition with even the extraction of beaver pelts. Second is that the nature of these resource-dependent communities have changed. And the big change that we try to, what it catches our geographical imaginations, is the growth of client communities in remote areas, rather than setting up communities to orchestrate resource extraction, setting up camps so workers can fly in and out, which really doesn't build community at a place of extraction and gives flexibility to corporations when they inevitably pull out. And third is that resistance today, beyond Indigenous resistance, but also in different types of coalitions, of course, Indigenous resistance at the core of it, is still based a lot on ecological modernization questions in Canada. The fact that we're fighting still over pipelines and how much we're going to keep in the ground and how much we're going to take out, that drives politics still in Canada, as well as Western alienation in the recent election. And lastly, as Lisa mentioned, that even if we are not dependent necessarily on resource extraction at this very sense and across Canada, there's different elements related to resource extraction that we still are dependent on, and that is the financialization of resource extraction. In fact, this is Toronto, is a center of mining capital globally. And even if you don't think you're reliant on resource extraction in Canada, you're reliant on Bay Street. And that's some of the things that we want to just get bring up to say that Innes's ghost is still very much with us. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for that unique endorsement. I'm going to take that endorsement as a sign that you're willing to fund a book tour. I'll go from there. Okay, for the next speaker, I believe from the next section of the book, State Capital and Institutions, Tanner Mirlis from, is it Ontario Tech?
Ontario Tech,
University.
Recently rebranded. Thank you very much.
We're going to talk about the political economy of communications.
Yeah, this is really great. Thanks so much to the editors. I'm so happy to be part of this collection. When I started my PhD in communication culture at York University back in 2002, a second year course was on political economy of communication. And in that course, one of the key readings was Vinnie Moscow's The Transformation of Communication in Canada in the version of the edition by Wally Clement and Leah. So at that point, I became really interested in political economy of communication as a theoretical methodological approach to studying communication, culture, information, and media. And I've subsequently sort of done quite a lot of that since then. So the contribution that my chapter aims to make is a broad overview of the political economy of the ICT and cultural industries in Canada today, focusing on continuity and change. The first two sections of the chapter essentially try to identify the key corporations and sectors that constitute the cultural industries in Canada. Often when you use the word cultural industries, we're kind of like, what's in a word? What are actually we referring to? How can we actually sort of develop some kind of diagnostic or analytic to actually concretely study these institutions and their workings? So the first section of the chapter sort of does that, just to get a working definition, that's sort of a concrete identification of the different sectors and companies that constitute cultural industries. The next section is just a really, really brief overview of the political economy and communications approach, kind of like a plea for this approach to studying communications and culture, just sort of synthesizing and building upon what previous scholars in the area have said. The third section focuses on the continuation of capitalist logics in the cultural industries, and so I just look at how very rudimentary and basic capitalist logics continue to play out through the contemporary cultural industries today. The fourth section looks at the relationship between the cultural industries and the Canadian state. Drawing from sort of state theory, how the state continues to facilitate and legitimize accumulation of the cultural industries, the number of different mechanisms and institutional support systems in place. The final section, I then take up the issue of the continuity of the U.S. empire, the U.S. as a continuing media, communications, cultural empire, and its relationship to Canada, with emphasis on social media platforms and digital streamers and the kind of policy questions that raises. And then in the concluding section, I highlight some emerging sites of struggle within and around culture and the cultural industries in Canada. And I'll just sort of briefly gloss those in conclusion. So I say, the role of the political economy communication researcher is to hold a mirror to the power of the Canadian corporate class and state to influence communications and culture in order to understand the social dimensions of this arrangement, and also, and importantly, to shed light upon the sources of hope, the collective and the individual and group responses, potentially resistant social movements, and moments that may interrupt, transform, and reach beyond the present arrangement. Any scholar in this area worth their salt will identify, engage with, and learn from the emerging sites of struggle in and around communications and culture in Canada and beyond. These include, but are not limited to, class struggles over the precarious conditions of work and labor in the cultural industries, struggles over the juridical policy and regulatory framework of the state that aim to reform and push beyond the current arrangement of the capitalist cultural industries, struggles over the mediatized representation of reality by mainstream media corporations, and also those produced and circulated by alternative and activist media organizations in society. Struggles over the connotative meanings given to socially resonant signs like nation, security, society, class, democracy, capitalism, socialism, the environment, rich and poor, man and woman, black and white, common sense, the good life, the future. What are the connotative meanings we give to these signs, and how do we articulate them to progressive struggles? Struggles over the interpretation of popular culture texts. We can sort of do our resistant readings and perhaps even invite members of the community to come and learn about the class politics of films like Sorry Not to Bother You, by engagements like Film Social and otherwise. And finally, struggles in higher education over the role, content, and goals of communications and cultural studies curricula. I conclude by saying the struggles for and against inequality, oppression, environmental sanity, war, and imperialism are also communicational and cultural struggles being taken up by a plurality of actors in and through communications and culture today. today. Newspapers, magazines, ad songs, TV shows, films, video games, and websites are significant spaces where many of the central social struggles to maintain or transform the existing political economy of 21st century capitalism are waged and staged, legitimized and delegitimized, won and lost. In this regard, the political economy of communication remains a vital and useful theoretical and methodological approach that encourages and enables scholars to participate in such struggles, let's hope they be socialist struggles, to understand and change the cultural industries and change the world for the better. That's the good.
Thanks, Tanner. Okay, moving into the section on social services restructuring, we're going to hear about two chapters in this section, I believe. First, from Hugh Armstrong, who will talk about, oh, and Jackie Schoenier, okay, great, who will talk about long-term residential care.
Let us add our thanks to the editors, to the publisher, Miguel Queens, and to the Research Center for hosting this. Pat and Tamara can't be here, but the two of us
we understand.
We're part of a big research project, which has now been going for 10 years. I'll try not to talk too long, but we've got a lot of stuff.
then it is long-term care.
First, a bit of context. Neoliberalism. Neoliberalism can be seen as an ideology. It can be seen as a mode of governance. It can be seen as a set of practices. All of them with a pro-market bias. The global penetration of neoliberalism has been profound, but it's also been uneven, in part because of contestation. To take the case of Canadian healthcare, which we keep taking, our public social program, Medicare if you want, enjoys wide and deep popularity. One of the things this has meant is that privatization is by stealth. Our chapter is focused on nursing homes in six countries, and especially in Canada, there is a gradually, and I want to emphasize gradually, aging population. But there's a lot of money in seniors. A growing minority of seniors, especially those in their late 80s and beyond, and it's getting closer, and there's a dash of self-interest in our looking at nursing homes, need 24-hour care. So their only option is congregate care. So what has the stealth strategies and the stealth practices to do with seniors, especially women? The first way they do it is by constricting access to nursing homes. Nursing homes receive quite a bit of public money, not enough, but quite a bit, to meet the needs of these residents, especially their medical needs and to a lesser extent the activities of daily living that they need help with, whether it's dressing or toileting or eating or moving around. Because nursing homes literally take years to get in. Placement in a nursing home, as I say, can take 2, 3, 5 years. Sometimes it's on 6 months. And this is after screening that the potential resident really needs it. Many residents and their families turn in desperation to retirement homes, which are overwhelmingly provided by the for-profit sector. And which have very indifferent quality. And they have the capacity to kick people out. If you don't pay enough, and it'll be $6,000 to $12,000 a month, think about how your pension is going to deal with that. Or if their needs become too high, they can just kick people out. Others do their best to cope at home. This is a shifting of responsibility to the private household. And it means especially more work by women. approaches feminist political economy, and Jackie will take over here.
So, those who do make it into the nursing home find that the care is heavily medical in nature, rather than, and what most seniors have told us that they want is emphasis on the conditions of care, their life, the conditions of life, and making that as enjoyable as possible. But instead, it is it's heavily medical, as I said, with neoliberal governing from a distance made possible through this array of accountability instruments like RIMDS. So assessment instruments are popping up in all sectors, but again, this is the one in long-term care. Most of staff, most of these workers, RNs, LPNs, and PSWs are women, underpaid and overworked, just given the increasing intensity of care required by those in nursing homes. And their employment is precarious with this growth in part-time and contracting out of care. And this, of course, leads to, ignores what we know about the relationship between continuity of care and continuity of caregiver. That is so important to seniors in long-term care. So the work of carers is also typically and often invisible, supplemented by a whole host of family members, volunteers, and for those who can afford it, even paid carers who are brought in to support those who are in the nursing home. So it's another shifting of responsibility to the vulnerable sector. Privatization by stealth also occurs in many other factors, many other features of long-term care, contracting out on food, on cleaning, and so on. And this is certainly widespread and it's growing. And certainly a lot of these approaches are taken from the business sector, even in those homes that are ostensibly not-for-profit. And of course, there's a long history of how much difference is there between for-profit and not-for-profit in this sector. So, in conclusion, please read Changing and this is Hughes' quote. There's clarity in this fine collection, even if neoliberalism blurs its distinctions.
Okay, next, I believe we have Greg Alp, going to talk about neoliberal urban restructuring. Greg is from the Department of Politics here.
This is my day to spend with Leah, since I was just teaching her a few hours ago on the history of kind of feminist debates in Canada, as well as Leo, who's here, was also teaching his old article on kind of the staples, his critique of the staples theory class, as well as, actually, I was also mentioning Stefan and you in the class earlier, and so there you go. And now Leah here at the end. There's a number of purposes that we took up in looking at urbanism in Canada. One of them is after doing a lot of studies with Carlo and others on austerity at the national level comparisons and the provincial level, was also wanting to look at the urban level, partly kind of on the basis of the old kind of cliche from public policy of street level bureaucracy or in participatory democracy or popular planning. You know, policy is what hits the street. To some extent, where austerity hits is particularly in urban politics. I was also wanting to think about this in terms of Canada's problems with urbanism, going back actually to the beginning of austerity in Canada, or aspects of austerity going back to the 1970s with the development of wage and price controls, the turning of wage austerity, the gutting of the National Urban Affairs Department, the turn to the monetarism of the bank account. So a very long span of kind of imposing austerity on urban settings. The other was, of course, in the context of her writing, is the movement from that longer-term trajectory of austerity to the expansionary austerity and under the context of more authoritarian neoliberalisms that came with the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008. that up. The other thing I think that was important to us in framing the discussion was, of course, the turning of the world, the majority of the world's population now living in urban settings, with North America being the most urban of settings of the world, and Canada, to some extent, by many measures, is more urban than the U.S. So there's kind of a context for understanding urban politics that was important to us. The final thing, of course, was political arguments and issues related to the urban left and the urban struggles as they were unfolding in Canada. If there was a specific guiding thesis, it was provided by Lefebvre, Henri Lefebvre, the urban theorist, in the following quote that we front the essay with. "There is nothing more contradictory than urbanness. On the one hand, it makes it possible to some degree to deflect class struggles. On the other hand, the city and its periphery tend to become the arena of kinds of actions that can no longer be contained or can be confined to the traditional locations of factory or office floor. The city and the urban sphere are thus the setting of struggle. They are also, however, the stakes of that struggle." So that was kind of the guiding themes that we wanted to deal with in terms of the essay. And looking at neoliberal urbanism, fiscal retrenchment, the reinvention of neoliberal practices, particularly the way that the urban settings in Canada have been the key point of development of new public management, monetization, user fees, et cetera, have been particularly developed at the urban level, and the forms of political opposition. In Canada, going back to the longer term of austerity, it's also the way that kind of multi-level governance has been restructured in Canada since the late 1970s, with downloading, withdrawal of universal social provisionism. Importantly, something that Stefan and Roger Kyle have emphasized in earlier editions of this has been the forms of competitiveness being developed in urban development planning and so forth. So that's what we wanted to focus on and frame the discussion. We do it then, as Carlo mentioned, in terms of three case studies, one of the Toronto and particularly industrial relations to indicate problems in the sphere of production and work, infrastructure problems in Montreal as a reflection of social reproduction, and in the form of fixed capital and support structures for the circulation of capital and people. And finally, housing in Vancouver, particularly directed to personal self-reproduction in families and households and so forth. To conclude, this is the point that we wanted to end, in fact, the political conclusion from our analysis. The local left has all but dissolved as an active force contesting local centers of power. The last decades or so of everyday urban politics in Canada, individual councillors attempted to leverage minor social measures out of the latest development scheme and condo complex, negotiating the trimming of municipal services on the least unfavorable terms, and supporting local, preferably green entrepreneurs and markets. There is nothing in any of this one could possibly conjure as the means to break with urban austerity. The left tradition has historically been quite different. Following from the Paris Commune workers' councils and water and sewer socialism, it has focused on the reorganization, democratization, decentralization of political and economic activity. The urban revolution was central, Lefebvre argued, to any transformative prospects. A revolution that does not produce a new space has not realized its full potential, and indeed has failed, in that it has not changed life itself, but has merely changed ideological superstructures, institutions, or political apparatuses. But this was never seen as a project isolated to a single urban center, for Lefebvre or us, a localism in itself as the objective of political resistance. Instead, local bases of power and self-administration had to be integrated into revolutionary projects to transform national state power and to internationalize political struggles and alliances against the world capitalist market. Any alternative politics in Canada today will have to produce a new urban space, a right to good work and living wages, a new infrastructure of free transit and public spaces, social housing for all, but also will have to be a project of rebel cities across, connecting across the networks and scales of the Canadian state. And this, I think, our essay integrates with all the other essays in the book. Thank you, Mark, Leah, Elenia.
As we move into
with the final section of the book. We're going to start with Leslie Wood from the Department of Sociology.
She had to leave, unfortunately.
Leslie had to leave. Okay.
Yeah. I went too long again.
It's not on you. Leslie's had a long and cool day. But that will pique everyone's interest because I'm sure everyone wants to know what Leslie had to say about social movements in Toronto and Montreal and theoretically. And she has a wonderful chapter in the book. So we move to Stephanie Ross, and who's going to talk about workers' movements. And I should also say I thank many people. At the beginning, I would also really like to thank Stephanie. It was really great to work with her on this chapter as well. And in addition to all of the joys of assembling an edited collection, writing an actual chapter for it was near the top.
Thanks, Mark. Well, let me echo Mark's comments on that. I mean, Mark and I worked together quite closely in the years that I taught here at York. And I've been at McMaster for the last 3 years now. But we worked very hard together on contributing to building the Global Labor Research Center. And so we spent a lot of time together on that project, but we've never written together before. And so this was a really excellent opportunity for us to explore some of our shared intellectual commitments, and it was very dreamy. We had a great time, and I mean, hopefully you'll read the results of that. Let me also echo his comments in talking about the important influence of this book series, and what an honor it is to be included in it. Like Mark, I actually also was starting out as an undergraduate in political science in 1988 at Carleton University, and little did I know that I was part of the York Carleton political economy pipeline. I guess if you reflect on, you know, who's in these books, like there is a critical mass of people who have been influenced and trained by people centered in those two institutions. And we might say, oh, well, that's all, you know, very internal, you know, inside baseball, it's an kind of ancestral community, but there is something important and unique that needs to be preserved about the political economy tradition that, as a political scientist, I can tell you, is not being preserved or reproduced elsewhere in this country or internationally. And so it's actually a very important thing that this book was published, that this series is continued on, and for me, very personally, important to be part of it. So our chapter is called Work and Workers' Movements in Canada After the Great Recession. And so what we really were trying to do in this chapter was take stock of the state of workers' movements in Canada after 2008, and try to take a bit of a bird's eye view of what was happening in both the what we would consider the official labor movement, the union movement, but also the parts of the labor movement that perhaps have been less well studied by the tradition of political economy, but really are some of the most important and dynamic contributions to the labor struggle today, which is the new forms of worker organization outside of organized labor, outside of the unions. So, you know, in taking this bird's eye view, we tried to engage with several key questions. First, how is work being transformed in the current conjuncture after 2008? And we wanted to try to ground our assessment, our exploration of the state of movements in those changing material conditions of work. I guess that makes us political economists, right? With that we take seriously that there is a concrete material context that shapes the forms of political expression and ideological expression at play in workers' movements. And we focus then on the implications that changing context of work has for unions' capacities, their capacities for bargaining, for organizing, and for political action. And then we talk about the way that those material conditions are also producing new forms of resistance. So the couple of the sections of the chapter look primarily at the rise and spread of precarious employment as a kind of master context for understanding what's going on with the labor movement, with workers' movements. And these sections of the chapter are really our entry into the competition to make labor studies the new dismal science and displace economics from that position. And so, you know, in some ways, these arguments won't be surprising to people here. You know, we talk talk about the way that the spread of precarious employment has served to both materially and discursively normalize insecurity and income inequality. And that while we can certainly point to different groups of workers experiencing precarity in very different ways, and that has real material effects on how they respond, that the precaritization of our lives comes to discipline the way that workers think about what's possible. And in so even those sections of the working class that are still relatively secure have precarity, the threat or the fear of precarity, as the guiding problem for their own political strategies and organizational responses. We talk then about the way that unions in both the private and the public sector are struggling to cope with the changing nature of work and of labor relations, both in the private sector, where I think we can say resistance to concessions has been sporadic, that unions have been unable to make anything more than small organizing breakthroughs. And I note in particular, you know, the moment in this country when national attention was being paid to the condition of fast food workers in the aftermath of the raising of the minimum wage in Ontario and Tim Hortons chain and franchisees began to roll back other forms of employment benefits. There was a moment of attention on the condition of fast food and retail employees that the organized labor movement was utterly unable to take advantage of in terms of organizing, in terms of reaching out to those workers, providing them with various forms of support. And so, to some extent, the impacts of precarity, the uneven impacts of precarity on both the most vulnerable in the working class, but those that still have some organizational capacity are important to understand, and that unions really are in a situation of managing decline, as Jay McAleenan has recently said. Even their organizing strategies really can be understood as managing decline rather than trying to make very high impact interventions in the sort of the representation of workers. We might also point to, of course, this happened after our chapter was published, point to the attempts to, in the public sector, to put in motion a different kind of political process in response, for instance, to the back to work legislation that was imposed on Canadian postal workers in 2018, and the kind of initial attempts on the part of community allies, whether in other unions or in community-based organizations, to blockade and picket, to try to push back against some of the legal restrictions that are being placed on FW, and how that was really quite, in some ways, stillborn. Never really that attempt to kind of push beyond the legal boundaries of normal industrial relations really never got very far. And so there are sparks and attempts to try to get out of the impasse that organized labor faces. There are some hopeful signs, but Mark and I try to explore why the experience of precarity continues and the desire to maintain organizations in that context of decline limits the political imagination of unions. We do spend some hopeful time in the chapter talking about new workers' organizations, and in particular focusing on the Fight for 15 in Ontario and other similar organizations of non-union worker mobilizations. And we note that, you know, those are some of the most important and dynamic movements that are on the scene in Canada. We note that those are movements that place a high emphasis on political rather than economic organizing, that, you know, Black, Indigenous, women of color are at the forefront of those organizations, in probably very strong contrast to the organized labor movement. that perhaps unlike most unions, except maybe we could say the public sector, they challenge the divide between workplace and community in a kind of a more deep way. So there are important sources of hope in this sector, but we do have to ask, how sustainable are these organizations and their efforts in the context of our experience in Ontario, where the really important achievements of the Fight for 15 were readily rolled back with the snap of a finger, the stroke of a legislative pen. And in the context of where, you know, the connections between those organizations and unions have been thin and not really elaborated, raise questions about the extent to which unions can learn from those new and dynamic forms of organization and whether those organizations have the capacity to not just sustain themselves but to extend beyond their activist base into what we might consider to be a mass workers' movement. So that is the summary of what we try to achieve in this. Hopefully it's not too depressing. It is at the end of the book, so you know, if you get to it, then great. But you might want to have your bourbon out by that time. But anyway, let me thank Leah, Carlo, Elena, and Mark for the very, very hard work shepherding this book to publication. It was a long haul, and you know, we're very grateful as a community that you did this work on our behalf. Thanks.
Okay, so our final speaker is also a co-editor, Olena Lubchenko, and in her chapter she looks beyond Canada to consider some of the analytic tools that can be used in other national contexts, looking particularly
So
at
as
Russia.
The most junior and nervous speaker.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, getting the sun dry.
Many households and those headed by low money
Yet, of course, historically, the critique of women's unpaid work in the home has guided official Soviet policymaking, and that critique has been central to the emergence of feminist political economy in Canada and its critique of male student political economy. So I point to the potential offered by a dialogue between the feminist political economy tradition as it emerged in Canada and sociological literature in Russia on changing gender relations and social policy from the Soviet to the post-Soviet era. And I believe that such internationalization of the political economy, but also engagement and encounter with literature, as well as challenges offered by a new case, they sort of help us expand our understanding of how late capitalist relations of production and reproduction, importantly, come to operate in different sites and at different scales, such as post-Soviet states. At the same time, I believe they also help expand the explanatory power of feminist political economy, its theoretical framework, and make it more relevant to other contexts beyond Canada, right? So I hope that in the future, more contributions in the Canadian political economy sort of take this direction. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it for our lineup of speakers. Believe it or not, there's 10 more chapters to hear about. I have notes. Maybe I'll just. We have the room for another half hour, so we could take some questions, have some discussions. There's also refreshments. Thank you to the Global Labor Research Center and to McGill Queen's University Press for providing us with refreshments. If people would like to raise questions or points of discussion, we could do that now. I'll open the floor, and or we can talk amongst ourselves.